Hello and welcome to Risky Talk, the podcast where we talk about risk and how to talk about risk. I'm your host, David Spiegelhalter, and this episode is all about how to do journalism with data and numbers.
A number on its own actually doesn't mean anything. It needs context and it needs a story.
We're very often trying to get those numbers out of the copy and into the visuals. So the visuals are like a way of making you eat your greens.
If you're not entertaining people, then no one will read you.
There's no point being trustworthy if you're dull. Over the last year, the headlines have been dominated by data. We've all become grimly familiar with case numbers, daily death counts, even specialist terms like the R number and vaccine efficacy have had their moment in the media spotlight. But even as we tentatively ease our way out of the pandemic, numbers will always be a fundamental part of news journalism. Political debate, especially around elections, is characterized by high-frequency statistical crossfire, immigration figures, unemployment estimates, economic forecasts, funding promises. And let's not forget the Brexit campaign bus that so dubiously claimed that the UK sends £350 million to the EU every week. And what about the reporting of the latest scientific research? This too is laden with statistics. And we need these numbers to make sense of the world, to help decide who we vote for, to guide personal decisions about healthcare and lifestyle. And so journalists play a key role. But it's a tricky job. Statistics need care, context, and caveats. But what drives a good story is emotion. So how do we do both? How can journalists balance the need for accuracy and nuance with the imperative to craft engaging, accessible stories? And so here to help me explore all this, I have some number lovers and storytelling stalwarts. Tom Chivers is the science editor for Unheard. He's won 2 awards from the Royal Statistical Society for Statistical Excellence in Journalism. And his forthcoming book, written with his cousin David, is called How to Read Numbers in the News. It's a beginner's guide to spotting dodgy stats in the headlines, but it's also a campaign for good quality statistical journalism. Tom, welcome to Risky Talk.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Keelan Barr is the editor of data projects at The Guardian. As a journalist, she's researched and written hundreds of data-driven stories, from tracking €34 billion worth of EU funding to the UK's poor record on rape prosecutions and to making sense of COVID death counts and many more. So Keelan, welcome to Risky Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Milner is the programs director for National Numeracy, a charity that helps people feel confident with numbers and everyday maths. So, Paul, welcome to Risky Talk.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me on.
Now, we always like to start these conversations in the Risky Talk podcast with a simple but important question. What's the aim of the kind of communication you do? And as journalists, what are you actually trying to achieve? Okay, Tom, let's start with you. Are you trying to entertain, inform, persuade, or some combination of those?
Well, it's always going to be some combination, isn't it? Because if you're not entertaining people, then no one will read you. Like, I always think my primary duty or the first thing I'm trying to do is to say true things, right? Or to get as close to something that is factually accurate as you possibly can, with all the suitable caveats of uncertainty and the limits of what you can know and everything. But then once you establish what is true, then try and say that in as persuasive and entertaining a way as possible. So I suppose, yeah, the core duty is being correct, is saying true things.
Do you ever find yourself tempted to try to persuade people to change their behaviour if you feel something is very strongly?
Do you know, two things on my mind at the moment is it's been almost exactly a year since the start of COVID, and I was trying to think about what we know now that we didn't know then. And we know now, for instance, that hand washing and surface transmission is far less important than we originally thought it was. And we know that things like masks and ventilation and meeting, you know, indoors versus outdoors is much more important and much more of a relevant thing. So if I were to write something about that, I wouldn't be thinking I am therefore trying to change people's behavior exactly, but I'd be trying to change what they believe about these sets of things. And you'd hope it would be implicit. If you believe that masks are more important and the hand washing is less important, that will naturally translate into action, into behaviour.
Are you trying to persuade people to have true beliefs?
Yes, that would be my ideal thing, you know, as far as you can. Map is not the territory and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, get people's mental maps to correspond as well as possible to the real territory.
Right. Okay, Keelan, I mean, I'd love to know your views about this. So you lead a team of data journalists. Data journalism wasn't even a job title that existed some time ago. But The Guardian has played a crucial role in this. You know, the data, I remember the data blog starting, you know, really some time ago, in the late 2000s. So what does a data journalist do that's distinct from what a regular journalist does?
Yeah, it's difficult, right? Because data journalism is a broad discipline. And people really think of it as kind of running the gamut from more visual-oriented pieces of journalism more to kind of more traditional forms of the written word through to interactives. But I think kind of what binds all of those things together is that data is really used as the primary source in telling a story or investigating a particular issue. So really, you know, this is something I'm often trying to explain to colleagues as well in terms of making the case for using data as a core piece of journal, part of our journalism, is that it's really seeing data as an integral source and usually the core component of a story. And that would be, to my mind, what defines a piece of data journalism from any other piece of journalism.
So it's data-driven stories. What recent examples do you feel illustrate the value of data journalism in particular?
Well, I guess just as Tom's mentioned, you know, it's been a year where we've just been inundated with stories that are driven by or based on or a reaction to a data set. So, you know, so much of the reporting around COVID in terms of trying to understand in the early stages, the progress of the disease, and then the progress of the impact of lockdown and restrictions on living, that's been the core focus for us for the past year. And it's been a big change for my team, because quite often we have had more luxury of time to really get to grips with the data set and really understand it. But COVID has made that something of the past. For the past year, we've just been, you know, racing to keep up and understand what the numbers mean, really, and do our best to communicate that with our readers.
You made very clear that these stories are driven by data, but this data doesn't just drop into your lap, presumably. Sometimes you have to go out and hunt for it.
Yeah, quite often the most interesting stories we get are not served up in a clean data set from the ONS or a government agency. So a lot of stories that we've done in the past that might be more investigative or more trying to kind of get to the core of an issue, in some of those examples, we would FOI for the data. So we would ask for data sets or...
Sorry, I'm just going to jump in to say FOI stands for Freedom of Information. It's just a way to request information from public authorities, and they've got a legal obligation to respond. Okay, back to Keelan.
Usually, actually, what is very interesting, rather than the kind of cleaned up data set that we get in the public domain, which is some part analyzed, sometimes we're looking for the actual raw data, the actual kind of underlying, the data that underlies the public facing data set. So those are, you know, those are not easily attained from government agencies. They're usually not in the public domain. FOI is a way in, but also sometimes we revert to scraping data sets from, say, government websites or other places, or taking data sets out of PDFs and trying to structure them into spreadsheets. So it's, you know, it's broad. It's a really broad job. But that's what makes it so interesting.
So I can't resist asking for your comment about what you feel about the way in which the government do provide data for public use.
It's really hit and miss. I think anybody who's worked with public data is aware that it's really hit and miss. And we're in so much of a better position now than we were a decade ago, because the open data movement really did change the thinking and the framing of data and its power and its potential for informing people. And, you know, this idea that it builds transparency and trust. And I think that really revolutionized government's perspective on publishing data, but there still is a long way to go. So quite often, you know, we get data sets that are very interesting, but perhaps we can't really use them. You know, there are some, I can think of quite a few examples where we'd love to do stories with them, but they just don't tell the full picture. But yeah, the format is something that we often grapple with, but I think it's getting better. I think it is getting better. There's more data than there has been in the past.
Yeah. And I suppose your objective is similar to Tom's. You're trying to, you know, make people's understanding correspond more closely with reality, whatever that is. And I suppose raise the level of the discussion about topics. Is that what you'd say you're trying to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, similarly, we face the challenge, the kind of key challenge that we face is trying to strike the balance between clarity and communicating something that people will engage with and also being accurate. So, and that is something I think when it comes to data is absolutely fundamental, but it's also a great challenge in getting people to read your stories that are very often, you know, potentially immersed in numbers.
Yeah. Absolutely right. And that's why Paul is here, because we know what we're trying to achieve. We've got to know something about the audience. A key part is understanding what they know and what they feel about, as Keelan pointed out. Are they going to get hold of all this stuff that's coming at them in the media about these data? So I know it's a big question, but you know, for a general UK audience, what are the levels of numeracy in different parts of the community, and how do people feel about all these numbers and stats that they have always been bombarded with, but over the last year it's been an avalanche?
Well, I think probably the first thing to understand is that generally speaking, people's numeracy is not as good as their literacy. In fact, there's only 1 in 10 adults whose numeracy is stronger than their literacy. So I think potentially in terms of journalism, I can see that different publications are quite clear on the reading level they write at. You can see this if you compare tabloids and broadsheets, for instance. But whatever reading level you're writing at, it's probably worth considering using the numeracy at a lower level. In terms of the skills levels, David, in the UK with numeracy, and by numeracy, we mean being confident to use the right bit of maths, the right bit of basic maths in daily life or the workplace. We're not talking about algebra or trigonometry here. We're just talking about stuff that does come up in your life. Only 1 in 5 adults in the UK are working at a functional level of numeracy, which is the equivalent of a pass at GCSE, like an old C or above at GCSE. It's actually 22% of adults are working at that level. And more shockingly, around half of adults in the UK are working at primary school levels of understanding with numbers and data. And those statistics come from a major study that was done 10 years ago by the government called the Skills for Life report. They worked with 6,000 adults in England, and that's 10 years ago. So you might say, well, that was just England. And it's a while ago, but the work we've done since, there's nothing to indicate that the situation has changed in the 10 years, and there's nothing to indicate that it's any different in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. So that's probably the starkest statistic. Around half of adults have primary school levels of numeracy.
Goodness me. I mean, yeah, I am shocked, to be honest. I hadn't realised it was like that. So what do people kind of struggle with?
Generally speaking, the half of adults who I'm saying have the equivalent of primary school levels of numeracy will tend to struggle with percentages. Now, I think generally people will know what 50% or 100% or that 90% is most. But as soon as you're into, say, 15% of £65, or you're talking about percentage change, or understanding how much of a purchase price is VAT, a lot of people won't follow you there. Large numbers, rates per 100,000, billions. I think people know it's a large number, and they know a million's a large number, but the distinction between the two, I'm not sure is necessarily widely understood. Moving between percentages and fractions and decimals seamlessly, like knowing that 2/3 is about 67%, which is the same as 0.67, that tends to lose people. Stringing different operations together, say having to add some things together and then divide to get a solution. For instance, those post office parcel guidelines. I don't know if you've ever tried to work out how... What the size versus width is that you're allowed to post in a certain for a certain cost. Interpreting graphs that have more than one bit of information on them. So it's quite a lot of stuff, and it's potentially quite a big barrier. Or to flip it round, it's potentially an opportunity to widen the audience and reduce the bubble, so to speak, if you can get more people understanding this stuff.
Yeah, Paul, thank you so much for that. I mean, when you think that we're trying to communicate ideas of false positive rates from diagnostic tests and vaccine efficacy of 90%, it makes it seem a bit of a challenge. So, Keelan, I mean, your audience, The Guardian, is, you know, perhaps not a random sample of the population, but how do you check that anyone actually understands what you're doing and what you're saying?
Yeah, it's really tricky. It is really, really difficult, like to communicate numbers around COVID that are so essential and really impact people's lives at the moment. And people want to understand them. You know, people really want to engage and get to grips with how these numbers are impacting them so they can interpret it for themselves, I think. And for us, the challenge in reporting numbers accurately, but also getting people to engage with them, often means that we take, you know, we usually in the first couple of paragraphs of a story focus on one thing and focus on usually one number quite clearly. And sometimes that means sacrificing some of the more complex things that we might find as journalists looking at the data, things we might find a bit more interesting. But sacrificing having those at the forefront of the story and using them later in the piece. And then, of course, with all the caveats and all the limitations of the data, quite often that gets put quite far down in a story, because usually you think, well, someone's got to this point in reading a story, they're going to be engaged and want to know what the limitations are as well. But that's a real challenge. Sometimes you feel that paragraph, the kind of nerd graph, should be up higher, because you want people to really get the full context of the numbers that you're talking about. So you're being transparent with the reader. But it's a huge challenge. And I think, you know, working within a team where we understand the figures and we can have conversations about them usually puts us somewhat at odds with maybe the general news editors on the broader news desk, who might take the story, pull some numbers out and rewrite the headline. So there's often a conversation between, you know, the broader news editors and people on the data team about, you know, clarity and communicating the numbers versus not bogging the piece down with numbers either. And that is really important, because as Tom was saying at the beginning, you need people to read this stuff. You're only writing it because you're hoping that people are going to read it. So that's a challenge.
Yeah. My little phrase I use all the time, there's no point being trustworthy if you're dull. So, I use Twitter a lot, you know, and I really enjoy that, but I kind of know that that's not a representative sample of people who I'm, you know, tweeting out to. Tom, you like Twitter. You know, how do you, can you grasp what people understand from that? How do you feel it?
I was just thinking about this, because those were a slightly alarming set of numbers that Paul was giving out there, you're talking about how you know whether people can understand it, and one way I can be sure that some people understand what I'm saying is I get feedback from Twitter users or from people in the, you know, people saying to me, like, this has explained stuff to me, I now understand it. And so you know, you can be sure that some people have understood it, and I think that there's a real selection bias problem there, isn't there? The people who get back to you saying, yes, this is really clear to me, well, you know, the people saying, I feel really stupid and didn't understand a word of that, probably won't get back to me. Or there won't be... Also, I mute the people who are mean about it, so I never hear from them anyway. But there is naturally a selection bias. I do think you can... It's also really interesting, Paul, what Paul was saying about numeracy not being lower than literacy, because one thing I have explicitly... That made my, for myself. I don't think I'm especially brilliant at maths. If you put an equation out, like Bayes' theorem out in front of me, I will struggle to. I can sort of sit there and work my way through all the brackets and the conditional probabilities and all that sort of stuff. But if I talk it through in language, I can explain it to myself and therefore to other people. So I can find it when you're doing somewhat more. If you're just talking people through, look, just. Some of the basic stuff, like there's no denominator in this number. If someone gives me the number of people who have died of being murdered each year, but you haven't told me how many that's out of, you can then say, look, if we take the larger number that a sensible sort of representative group of whom this is, and we can talk it through bit by bit. And I think a lot more people understand that rather than if you say, look at this simple equation with a big sigma in it and a line through the middle, where it's supposed to be. I get really stuck on that. And if you then sort of, look, this is actually, all these things represent fairly straightforward things that I can talk you through in natural language, then we can get to, take it to where people's understanding it, people's sort of more comfortable understanding.
Well, I'm going to be a bit flattering and think you're rather good at this. And you, what did you do? A philosophy degree?
I was a philosopher, yeah, philosophy at university.
A friend and colleague, Michael Blaslund, who did English literature, I think is one of the best people I know to explain statistics to people. So, this is not maths. This does not, require a maths degree to certainly to understand it, and particularly not to communicate it. You need a different set of skills, I think. What about graphs and charts? I mean, what you might call graphical literacy. We have seen a lot more visualizations, the number of bar charts and line graphs and things that are appearing on media and the websites has been extraordinary just over the last year. Paul, are you going to tell us that this is all doomed?
A picture paints 1,000 words, doesn't it? And we know that some people respond well to being explained verbally and some people respond well to seeing a graph. And I think some of the graphs are superb, actually, and it's been really interesting sensing the effort, the journalistic effort that's gone in over the year to make it clearer almost week by week. You can see slight improvements. I think the graphs can be hugely effective. As I mentioned earlier, I think ideally if they're just communicating one thing, so say a line graph of daily cases showing the two peaks with time going along the bottom axis, I think that's very clear and very effective. If you're starting to make comparisons between two different things on a graph, you may well lose people. But I think this is where the journalistic sort of art and skill comes in, because a number on its own, like 1,742, it actually doesn't mean anything. It needs context and it needs a story. 1,742, say, daily cases, when we were going up the first or second peak, was really bad news, wasn't it? It was quite scary. But the same number when we were coming down the other side was really good news and quite encouraging. So it's all about the context. And I think that is where as Keelan said, it being the core part of the story, but then the story needs to be woven around it so that people can draw their own conclusions and either be persuaded or at least make a sensible decision.
Okay. Tom, we're going to come on to putting numbers into context in a moment to give you a chance to plug your excellent list. But before that, can we just get on to the business of, the actual mechanisms of doing this communication? And because we talked about what you're trying to achieve, listening to different audiences. Keelan, can I ask you about this, what Paul raised about the amount of the information and story you can put into a graph? I've seen things improve hugely just from the Office for National Statistics, putting the explainers and the limitations on the graph itself about, the last few days were likely to be updated. Things get disrupted because of, bank holidays and that being inseparable from the presentation. What have you been developing sort of new techniques for trying to tell a better story with the graph?
So our aim with using visuals and stories is quite often to I guess, illuminate the broader data set that we might not get to do in words, right? So we're very often, we know that when people hit, you know, in a story, when people hit the third number, they start to disengage. So we're very often trying to get those numbers out of the copy and into the visuals. So the visuals are like a way of making you eat your greens. They do so much heavy lifting, but they should, in order to do that, they have to be really clear and really intelligible. So, you know, it's a there's a lot of demands made of a visual. But I think, yeah, as you were saying, there, you know, there's been so much improvement as well, with a lot more of the caveats being flagged in line in the visual rather than hidden down in a footnote, so that people really get the context with it. But it is difficult, because I think there's potential for visuals to be misleading as well. Very often, I think people don't pay attention to how the axes are labeled, and maybe the scale. And that was something that in the very early days with the kind of exponential growth of the virus, people got very, very confused about scales and what things were measuring and how, you know, the growth of the virus and in different countries was being communicated. So
putting logarithmic plots on to communicate was just disastrous, I think. So, Keelan, what about particular graphical techniques that you think, you know, do? We mentioned, though, putting the sort of warnings on the graph. What about the amount you put on the graph? How much do you dare put on a single graphic in The Guardian?
I think the most kind of complex we get to is showing a linear regression. And sometimes I think, you know, there'll be a very small group of people who will understand why the line has been plotted on the graph and what it actually means. But we still do it because it feels, when we're doing that level of analysis of data that's out there in the wild, it really feels like the onus is on you to be very, very clear with the reader how you've come to this conclusion, because often there's a lot of analysis in the background. So sometimes you're doing something quite complex in a chart, but I think that's probably the far end of, you know, of the complexity. And I think that is a huge challenge for readers. In those graphs, what people probably are likely to do is hover over it and see where their local authority or whatever it might be lies within, you know, within the scatter of the chart I'm thinking of is, I think it was cases and proportion of BAME people in a particular local authority. You know, people are usually looking for themselves in the data. But yeah, they have a huge component in a story. And I think quite often, you know, if you're not very data literate, they can help you, but you need people to interpret it to get the visuals right to begin with, to help the reader interpret it, to simplify it. That's part of the job.
Absolutely. Now, Paul, can we just come back to you on this point that Keelan raised about how gripping it is if you can find something that's local to you in the information? I think the BBC website has been very successful because it makes it very easy to put in your postcode and find out trace, you know, all the graphs for your area. I mean, do you think this is, you know, do you know how well this works, or a feeling whether this is a good way of getting people engaged with this more complex information?
I think it's a really good way of engaging people with numbers and data. I mean, it's something we haven't talked about here, because the skills levels in the UK, I don't think are the actual problem. I think they're the result of the problem. The problem we've found is actually people's confidence and their attitudes to maths, the way they feel about it. A third of adults say, I am not a numbers person in the UK, which I think doesn't just mean they're not very confident with numbers. It actually implies I'm hardwired not to be able to do maths very well. You know, it has that sort of ring to it. Maths anxiety, it's a commonly used phrase at our end, I suppose it would be. A lot of people feel physically upset when they hit numbers, and the net result is they'll avoid them. And we get examples every week of people saying, oh, I didn't go for that job interview because I knew there'd be a numeracy test. Or I can't help my children at home. I can't help them with the maths. It just, I can't, because I can't do it. Or I avoid reading this stuff about managing my money because it's got numbers in it. People will literally do all they can to avoid it. And that's quite a chunk of adults. Now, one way that you can engage people, if you're trying to get some numbers across, is to show the value of it. I suppose it's reminding people it's not maths, that's something they did at school and maybe didn't get on with. It's something that is real and valuable and useful in daily life, which includes, of course, reading in the media. So if you can introduce it with something that is very, has great value for them personally, it's about them, it's about their area, that is a great way of hooking them in rather than it just being something that's got numbers in it.
Mm, absolutely. And, you know, what you're describing, we can't get into this now, but it makes you realize that homeschooling must have been deeply traumatic for a lot of families when it comes to this. Mm. Yeah. Tom, I mean, when you talk about graphs, and you don't use graphs in your stories particularly, you know, it's verbal, you're limited to the numbers you use. I suppose I've got some real sympathy with trying to communicate a lot of these issues using text alone. We've been doing this weekly column in The Observer with Anthony Masters, which is great, but we give 350 words to cover a topic. Oh my, you know, there's this old thing of, you know, I didn't have time to write you a short letter. Writing, trying to get something into 350 words is more than twice as much work as doing it in 700 words. It's really, so, you know, and your book, yes, do the book, you know, it really addresses these issues. I think, you know, you've got a statistical style guide, which you're recommending for journalists, that looks really good, 11 points. The first one is put numbers into context, which is what, you know, we came to again and again, and which graphs are extremely good at, because you can take one point and show it how it relates to lots of other things. Where did you put that first? What about some other examples of where context is so vital?
Well, it's the context thing seems like the most basic. You know, if someone says 17 people have died of X this year, I have no idea if that, you know, it's like Paul was saying earlier, a number on its own is meaningless. They had two of them. Is that a big number? You know, two, well, I can't remember what the line was we used in the book, but something like two is the small number of hairs on your head, but a large number of gunshot wounds to the stomach or something. You know, it is. There's no such thing as a big or a small number. There's just numbers, and they are big and small in different contexts. So it's absolutely vital if you say, I don't know, example from the book again, if Britain dumps 6 million tons of sewage into the North Sea every year, that sounds like a lot, but what's the denominator? You know, and it's there's 54,000 billion tons of water in the North Sea. It still might not be great, but you know, it's the number you need to know that to have any sort of sense of whether or not this is actually important and something you should spend time on. Regarding graphs, you're right. I haven't used them much in my writing. I'm trying to a bit more actually now that, you know, I realize I work online mainly, so there's nothing really stopping me. And they can, a lot of the time, they can just say, and very quickly, they can just sort of point out really simply, look, this is, especially when a lot of my work is sort of taking some statistic in the news and saying, no, this is not as important as you think it is, or it's not as scary, or it's not, you know. And I remember last year, or 2019 maybe, I wrote a thing about a front page story in the Sunday Times about suicides going up in particular groups. And they said, you know, they've gone up 80% since 2010. And all you had to do was show a line of the numbers of suicides in this age group going back to 2000 or something like that. And it was just a wobbly line going all up and down all over the place. And it happened to be that in 2010, it went down really low. So you could then pick any other year and say, look, it's gone up by X amount since then. And just a simple, one really simple chart immediately, look, this is all you need to know. That is fine. That is straightforward. And I explained that in words in the copy, and I rather wish I'd just, look, here's your graph. You don't need anything else, you know. So putting things into context like that is whether you do that via a graph or via words is really easy. The other things we talk about are stuff like, I know this is one of your favorites, David, is using absolute risk as well as relative risk. You know, if something goes up by 40%, that doesn't mean very much to me unless I know that it goes up, my chance goes up from 0.1% to 0.14%. It's very different from going up from 10% to 14% or something. You know, these are big differences in learning about how likely it is that you are going to actually be affected by it. And then it's stuff about science journalism, like, you know, giving the sample size of the study, making sure that the studies you're reporting on are representative of the wider literature. And you know, if you're giving forecasts or sort of estimates, then give the uncertainty interval as well as just the point estimate, because otherwise you get this spurious certainty. And being wary about saying there are causal links, you know, saying X causes Y if you're just reporting on a study that says X is correlated to Y. You know, it's stuff that probably everyone in this podcast thinks of automatically now because it's so much part of the stuff we've been talking about and thinking about for years. But actually, it's not. Most people are perfectly capable of grasping it in my experience. When you talk about, they talk these things through, like, look, the, you know, these two numbers go up and down together does not mean that number A causes number B. And they can, you can explain that, you can see that perfectly clearly when you use the classic examples like ice creams go up and down, ice cream consumption goes up at the same time as drowning, you know, does. And then you say, well, obviously drowning doesn't cause ice cream consumption or vice versa, so there must be some third factor causing it. And this is all, but and people are very capable of grasping that when you explain it in straightforward terms, but when they're not on their guard for it, they, you can easily make causal things look, you know, things look like they're causally linked. We really didn't want to be sort of highfalutin or really complex with this style guide. So look, here are some really simple things that any journalist can understand and probably any reader can understand, but we'll push you quite a long way to the numbers you use and statistics you use being less misleading. I think that's really key. The one thing, our number 11, our sort of main one was, if you get a number wrong, just admit it, you know, and that's, God knows I do it all the time. And I have my Twitter feed is about one third. Yeah, I messed this one up.
Yeah.
We've corrected it since, you know, and I feel like that's really key and really important, sort of having humility and not being too proud to say, yeah, I screwed that one up, and that's really embarrassing, you know.
And it is amazingly easy to get things wrong. But I do like this list. So Keelan, is there any sort of statistical style guide that you use at The Guardian?
We do have a style guide that covers, you know, the entirety of our publication, and there are some points in there around numbers. And I think probably over the past year, the need for, you know, what Tom is writing about, like a rigorous set of rules to consider, right, when you're working with numbers, has become much more pertinent. But we don't have a set data style guide in-house. I think, you know, there is a grammar of graphics that people on that team understand, right, that you use, you know, certain colors or certain kind of formats to denote particular things. We've learned over time what people can take in a graph much more quickly or more easily, how we can make it easier for people. The grammar of graphics is well versed, but in using it in text, because it's not just the data team that's using data, it's the broader newsroom, you know, and there's loads of different ways of interpreting or using the same data set. You know, how a general reporter uses it is completely different to how somebody on the science team will communicate something.
The news desk difference, I remember you mentioned earlier the difference between the data team and the news desk. And I remember having, when I was a science, worked at the Telegraph and was doing a lot more sort of science writing in a traditional national newspaper, and you have a lot more of the conflict. So, well, this says it's gone up by 40%. That makes it our headline, and you see the science editors going, but you know, but you can't really say that because it doesn't. It's not as straightforward as that, you know. And you know, journalists aren't all brilliant at numbers. I remember one when a satellite was falling out of the sky once, and it said there's a 1 in 7 million something chance of it hitting someone or something like that. And they went, oh my God, that's more likely than being hit by a bus. And I took some time working out what had gone wrong, and I realized they'd got confused between the chance of it hitting somebody and the chance of it hitting you, and forgotten to divide it by 7 billion for all the people in the world. And it's not actually that obvious, right? It shouldn't. The tension with the sort of the real news hounds on the news desk who want the best story, and that's their job, is really difficult sometimes.
Keelan, there's been so many data stories over this time of COVID. Go on, pick one which you really feel you did a good job on.
I think, you know, the ongoing story that's really captured a lot of attention is that around the number of deaths in the UK, right? Because it's seen as this metric of how the government has performed. I think it's been really interpreted as that. And, you know, we, in covering that, we've done so many stories, usually approaching what the figure tells you and also what it omits, right? Because really what's become clear, I think, to a lot of people working with data this year is that just because you get a data set that's nice and clean and composed and structured well, where you can interpret it and analyze it for an audience relatively quickly, does not mean that it's telling you the full story. And the death figure is certainly one very clear example of that. And I think people, you know, when you start to make something that is already very complex, when you lose trust with people, very often then they start to disengage. And I think, you know, not just politically, but, you know, how we're kind of dealing with COVID and how people are perceiving the actions of the government really matters in relation to this number and whether they can understand it. So, you know, there's so many ways of interpreting and understanding the number of deaths. And part of that challenge is that there's three statistical agencies whereby we can get numbers of deaths in each of the constituent parts of the UK. And then the government figure records deaths within 28 days of a positive test. Whereas the statistical agencies, which will be the number which is used when we look back in years to come, looks at whether COVID is mentioned on the death cert. Now, for many years, that has been good enough as a way of understanding how many people have died of a particular illness. But in this specific example, you know, everybody is pivoted to looking at this government death within 28 days of a positive test. And then, of course, there's excess deaths. You know, there's so many ways of measuring this number. And I think for us, that has been one of the big focuses, just very slowly, story by story, trying to unpick the complexity behind what appears to be a very simple number.
It's very nice. Yeah. I mean, you can't assume that you think, oh, a death is a death, and it's far from it. Come on, Tom, what's all your stories on COVID? Which one do you feel most proud of?
I might go for a non-COVID story, if that's all right. It was a couple of years ago, you might remember, there was a story went around that the Sun, the Merseyside boycott of the Sun might have been what drove the Remain vote in that area. You know, that on Merseyside, everyone boycotted the Sun for the very reasonable reason that they did the horrible lies about Hillsborough. And so the sales of the Sun collapsed on Merseyside. And then they tried to draw a sort of causal line from that to the Merseyside region being much more Europhilic, much less Eurosceptic than the countryside as a whole. I felt like there was a lot of people sort of latched onto this because there's a sort of, you know, there's a narrative about the power of the tabloid press and the way, you know, we're all being misled by unscrupulous journalists and so on, which I'm sure there is real truth in it. But yeah, if you actually looked at the numbers, the number of people who actually read The Sun on Merseyside was something, or rather who stopped reading it, was something like 3% of the total population. They were trying to use this to explain a 10 to 15% swing in the vote. And I felt like that was the idea, that one person stopping reading the newspaper would stop four people from voting leave. So it felt like, so, you know, that felt like that needed a lot more explaining there. You know, that there's a lot more that didn't naturally sit with me, and yet no one sort of looked at those sort of fairly simple numbers. And, you know, it also didn't explain why Manchester and the next town over, which is, you know, they will hate me for saying this, but is a very similar city to Liverpool and has a real shared history. And they also, they very heavily voted Remain instead of Leave, you know, against the trend of the population in the country as a whole. And I sort of felt like this was a good use of, just like stepping back a bit, looking, so you've got this number, all this idea of the boycott and the number of people that stopped reading, but you haven't given me a denominator. How many people actually are there on Merseyside? How many people could this have affected? What is this a realistic number? I was proud of that because I was just proud of it because it felt like I was doing real academic work of like trying to unpick the thing myself, you know. But also I felt this is exactly what I think my sort of journalism in particular should be doing, is sort of trying to take these ideas that get lots of traction in the news and just say quickly look, if we just apply a bit of sort of common sense and not even like great mathematical brilliance to it or anything, just like let's look at the simple numbers and put them together and see how it fits up. Does it still make sense? And I was very pleased and proud of that one.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice. Again, it's just showing, you know, is this a big number? Is this number big compared with this number? This is not high level maths. This is just, just daring and having, as Paul's pointed out, having the confidence to look at a number and ask what it means instead of just saying, oh, God, it's a number and being shying away from it. I think it is so much of a mental attitude. So I do hope that we're going to have a slightly more numerate future. Well, that brings us to the end, even though I know I could go on gossiping about this stuff for hours. There's so much to take away from this conversation. I really like Keelan's idea of making just one number really clear up front. And Tom's list of points, the statistical style guide. Oh, it's a great list. I love it if the journalism world could sign up to those. So journalists, if you're listening, track down Tom on Twitter, check out his book and see if you can sign up to the manifesto. In the end, what everyone's saying, I suppose, is a number leading a good, clear story, setting out the context and the meaning, and maybe with a simple graph, then everybody benefits. So we've covered a lot. The care needed in communication, how important it is, how to use visualizations, knowing our audiences, making those stories vivid and relevant. So it just remains for me to say thank you to my extraordinary guests, Tom Chivers, Keelan Barr and Paul Milner. And it's goodbye from me and the Risky Talk team.
Risky Talk is produced by Ilan Goodman at the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication in the University of Cambridge.